You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
I am at the University of Northampton with Vice-Chancellor Nick Petford. Hello, Nick. Nice to meet you.
Hello.
To kick things off, you obviously at the head of a university now, but your route into academia in the first place was less than typical. I understand you weren't even on the cards for university at all at one point.
Yeah, that's true. So I think perhaps it's not so typical for a section of students, but probably atypical for vice-chancellors. So, yeah, I left school at 16. I had absolutely no interest, really, in going to university. Worked in a series of jobs, quite low-level manual stuff by and large. Ended up being the head van driver.
Head van driver,
yeah. I worked my way up from junior to head van for a large retail store in central London, which, to be honest, is probably one of the best jobs I've ever had.
Yeah, yep. Better than being a VC.
Right, do you know what? If they sack me tomorrow, I'm going to be a van driver.
Fantastic. And then what was it that prodded you in the direction of the academy?
Well, I kept getting made redundant. Which is often an interesting experience for those who've been through. And I got to a time in my life where I thought I need to really knuckle down and do something for myself. So my route into higher education is non-traditional in that sense, but I've absolutely witnessed the transformative power of education from a personal level. And so at University of Northampton, our mission statement, very simple, to transform lives and inspire change. I've been on that journey, so it really resonates with me. So I'm very proud to be working for a university that puts student experience and the transformative power of education at the heart of what it does.
Mm. We're speaking shortly after the Office of Fair Trading announced that it is to scrutinise higher education. It was our lead news story in the magazine this week. I mean, what that sort of suggests is that higher education now truly is a market. What's that going to mean for VCs like yourself, for institutions in general? It could lead to higher fees, it could lead to more fee discrepancy, bigger universities, more affluent universities charging more. Where do you see it going?
Yeah, I think it obviously there's the commentators who kind of look in on the sector, you know who they are, they write about this sort of stuff every week, with their views on what higher education should or shouldn't be doing. I mean, they've made it clear and that it is a market. Universities are businesses. I mean, I think they always were. We're autonomous, self-governing institutions of various different governance structures. There's no one type of university in terms of how they're governed and how they're legally constituted. So we've always been semi-autonomous from the state anyway. If you look at international students, that's been a pretty much unregulated market since we've been recruiting overseas students. So the university has always been used to this sort of behaviour. Of course, the big step change now is thinking of home students in this way. But it's not without precedent at all. And I actually find that idea quite exciting. Mm. I think some of my other VC colleagues and perhaps members of staff in universities feel threatened by it. I can see opportunities here, and I'm not too worried at this stage about possible negative aspects of the marketisation of higher education.
No. I mean, since 9K fees came in, I think Northampton, you were telling me the average fees are sort of 7,000, high 7,000s. I mean, are there plans to increase that? And would you appreciate the flexibility to increase it still further? Were that appropriate?
Absolutely. I mean, it was interesting that the whole debate about how you sort of price education and who would charge what is being part of that was for me a really interesting time because you could see why you might want to go at 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, up to 9,000. And yet everybody, what do? They bunched up at the high end, which is actually following a pretty straightforward economics principle that in a market where there's lots of information, which higher education does provide, you're all going to cluster at the sweet spot, which is towards the higher end. So I think that was inevitable. I think it was naive of politicians to think that there would be a spectrum and there'd be lower cost providers and higher cost providers in the state sector. I think always they would go for the higher end. So we're at with NET. Well, obviously the bursary schemes help. So there's the our headline price is 8,750, and that'll probably go to 9,000 in the next. For next year. But when you then consider the sort of, if you like, the cashback deals, bursaries, etc., net, I think we're at about 7.8 or 8.2, something like that.
Okay, yes. But is that naive, maybe, politicians to say 9K and expect a spread of fees? Would it be naive of them to remove that cap and not expect it to lead to a proliferation, a massive proliferation crisis?
Well, I think the problem with the cap, and you can understand from what political party is going to go to the next election saying, yeah, we're going to make it more expensive to go to universities as a vote winner. It's just not going to work, is it? Mm. However, the risk universities face, a very real risk, is of course to do with inflation. And the fact that £9,000 this year won't be worth £9,000 less year. So the erosion on the fee over the next decade is significant. And it's quite easy to do a financial forecast which shows that if the cap remains at £9,000, in the next decade, a number of universities are going to be, including ours, could be potentially in financial difficulties. So something has to give at some stage.
Sure. And then you hear the Oxford VC last week sort of talking about £16,000 fee. He says that's the value of his institution's degree to undergraduates. I mean, is it possible to work out that kind of figure, and how do you go about it? Would you, it's an interesting figure to band about, isn't it?
It's an interesting figure. And of course, the beauty of this is that it's almost it's been a discussion that's never been had really in UK higher education. Around the world, it's different. I think it's, Oxbridge is a luxury brand. Mm. And they will get, I'm sure it was pretty price inelastic, up to a large number of pounds. So, we wouldn't be able to charge that. And I wouldn't want to, actually. But some universities in the UK who high brand value will be able to charge 17, 18, 20,000 pounds a year in the future. I'm sure of that.
Staying with finance, you've written for us a number of times on a number of issues. Most recently, looking at the falling cash reserves at many UK universities. You've alluded to financial difficulties there as well. If the fee system isn't looked at, it's not just a worry for Northampton. It's the sector as a whole. But one thing I notice is we get press releases all the time from US institutions. We've raised $500 million here. We've raised quite eye-watering figures. Are UK universities active enough in this area, do you think, in making sure they're bringing in cash? It's all very well looking for tuition fees, but fundraising on that side of things.
Yeah, so perhaps there's two aspects to that. I mean, the first one, just to backtrack a bit, around the value for money piece, I think that ties into the student experience. It's about universities continuously seeking to be more effective and more efficient in how they run their financial business. Ian Diamond produced the Diamond Review, which challenged universities to be more to take more care in looking to be efficient and effective. And a key part of that, which I'm involved in, is procurement. So how can universities, if you look at the second biggest slice of the pie of university spend after staff, which is about half of the money that we spend every year, the second biggest, about 30%, is on purchasing goods and services. It's huge. If this university is £30 million, now where are savings in there? There could be significant savings, I think there are, which would be equivalent to recruiting X number of overseas students. And so because of I think the need to sharpen up where we can on procurement, I'm involved in a committee called Procurement UK, which provides oversight and strategic direction to the UK board to act out some of the procurement issues that were raised in the Diamond Review. Mm-hmm. So so that's one thing. There's scope to save through buying more cleverly. On the philanthropy side, Shirley Pierce, who's the ex-VC at Loughborough, produced a very good report just last year, talking about how UK universities could get better at raising funds from different sources. As you say, the Americans are fantastic at it. We are, other than Oxbridge and some other universities who are very good at this in the UK, laggards, I would say, as a sector. But the UK is different from the US.
True.
And it's a harder sell. But there's no excuse not to do it. So I think in future you'll see far more effort, as we're doing here at Northampton, in focusing down on major projects. And it's not just sort of raising £5 million for a new science block named after somebody. I think what investors, what high net worth individuals and others would be looking for in future are projects to invest in that actually show real social good and social value and social return to the communities which universities are based in. So I think that's an area that we want to explore in more detail.
Sure. I mean, that brings us to Northampton as a social enterprise institution. So tell me a bit more about that. I got a bit of information from the university saying universities will be failing in their responsibility to society and students if they do not develop the skills required by social entrepreneurs, or words to that effect. So why is it so key? I mean,
it's key for us because we have decided that our university outreach, our mission, should include helping develop social value in the communities in which universities are based. The social enterprise sector is growing quickly in the UK. It's a lot of SMEs, so again, that ticks boxes. Universities working with SMEs is always seen as a good thing, but we like to focus on, in addition, those SMEs that offer social value. Can be referred back to procurement in a sense, because what I'm keen on is getting universities as clusters, if the will is there, to buy on bulk from social enterprises to help drive that part of the economy. So universities, you know, driving growth through purchasing from organisations that have environmental and social values is, I think, a great thing universities can do. I mean, there are examples of cities doing it. Toronto, for example, has a sort of social inclusion, social innovation policy where they do exactly that. So. Sure. Great opportunity for universities to work more closely. So for Northampton, we focused on that. We tied into the student experience and employability. So if you come to this university and you're interested in social enterprise, we offer you the opportunity as a placement student to work out in the community in a social enterprise. One that we know of, or one that we own, because we're actually starting to buy them now, or part invest in social enterprises, which gives us a good network for student placements. Most excitingly, students, set your own one up. Set your own social enterprise up. You know, be a social entrepreneur in the university. We'll support you and help you on that adventure.
And are they keen? I mean, is this something that students look at the university and think, oh, that's the place for me because of this approach? Are you getting that sort of feedback?
They are keen, and it's still early days, but it's a great question, because to me, you know, the real sign of success will be in 4 or 5 years' time when we read on the UCAS forms, you know, why is a student, personal statement, why do they want to come to University of Northampton? It's because of what you're doing around social enterprise, social entrepreneurship. And once we start seeing that come through, that to me is a real sign of success.
Sure. Northampton's going through a bit of a restructure. There's going to be a very a big sort of bricks and mortar development over the horizon. But before we get onto that, you've sort of made the pages of the THE on a couple of occasions for sort of changes to staffing at the institution. I mean, we won't draw on it, but there's a story in 2011 about your desire to cut expenditure on support staff, focus more on academic staff, justified by the sort of desire of students, and that's what's important to them, which is a perfectly logical argument. But I mean, these sort of issues, I think it was a UCU vote of no confidence. These are just the issues that a VC has to deal with as part of what needs to be done.
They do, and it just comes with the job. I mean, I think what tends to happen is that if there's a restructure going inside a university, there'll be two sides to the argument, and often the press like to go for the more negative sides, your good paper notwithstanding, of course. So there's an industrial dispute heading towards us quite soon, and I'm sure that'll be reflected in interesting ways. You do have to make difficult decisions as a vice-chancellor, because universities, at the end of the day, are businesses. Mm-hmm. You know, I've just been talking to some of the new staff at the university, and one of the questions I'd like to ask is, how much do you think it costs to heat and light a university every year? And so for one like ours, our size, it's nearly £2 million, which is going up 10% year on year. Look at all the fuss about energy costs.
Absolutely.
You know, the same thing applies to universities. It costs us a lot of money. So where does that money come from? It doesn't come from a cheque from the government. Often you get a blank response, actually, from people that just don't think about it. It actually comes from, ultimately, student fees for a university like ours. So it's the money that we can earn, that we can trade in a marketplace to attract students, is what pays to keep the lights on. So that's a highly commercial aspect of what university life is all about. And so within that change and those all of that sort of a heady mix of commercialism and marketization, etc., you do as a vice-chancellor have to make quite tough decisions about staffing.
Sure. And bricks and mortar as well. You've got a new campus opening, well, in theory, in about 6 years' time, 5 years' time. How can you take me through that? I mean, that's a massive investment, isn't it? We're talking about keeping the lights on. Where do you find the money to build a multi-million pound university campus?
It's a huge. I mean, just to sort of step back a bit, we just a few, if you like, health warnings up front. We haven't got planning permission yet. We put draft planning permission in to Borough Council. We're not expecting any problems. We've been working behind the scenes for about 2 years on the project. Mm-hmm. What gives us the opportunity is that the centre of Northampton, along the riverfront, there's 6 miles of really high-class brownfield site which hasn't been used, and that's been designated as an enterprise zone through the local enterprise partnership, which gives us a great opportunity to move in to a new location under the enterprise zone remit, which is not so strenuous planning permission and other interesting lures as well. So. Mm-hmm. That's good. It's playing to the local agenda, the regional agenda about growth. It's embedding a sort of a knowledge economy at the heart of a town, which is Northampton. The project envelope, in terms of the finances, is big. It's about £330 million, which will make it one of the bigger relocation projects probably in the last decade in terms of UK universities. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity for this university. Money is cheap on the money markets. Where would the financing come from? Well, it's a mixed use that we've put in for in terms of planning, so there'd be opportunity to relocate the university, but there's also going to be residential, there'd be other commercial partners we could work with, and perhaps retail as well. So it's very exciting. It's bigger than just the university, although the university is key to its success. The money will come from a number of sources, from our own savings, from land receipts. We'll sell land. It can come from the local enterprise partnerships. There's some interesting financial devices that are available to us, and also from money markets, perhaps through a bond issue, sort of thing that De Montfort did recently, Cambridge and Manchester, etc.
And there must be work to do with the community as well. I mean, it's obviously a bit great to have the university at the heart of the town, but you must have to work with the people who live there to make sure they know what's happening. There must be quite a lot of outreach work going on, I'd imagine, to speak to the townspeople.
There is, yeah. I mean, we do a lot of these presentations. We show the video flying through what it looked like and talk about the financing of it, talk about the great benefits to having 2,500 students in the town centre buying things. All of that economic impact that will arise from the relocation. And at the end of the day, the questions come back to car parking. Car parking dominates absolutely everything. We need to work with the highways agencies to make sure that road access is there, yeah. And all the rest of it. But it's incredible how these really big, exciting projects, which are hugely expensive, have massive regenerative power, can change the whole face of towns and cities, end up often being arguments about, yeah, but where do I park my car?
Just put a multi-storey car park on the side of it.
Oh, well, that's one issue.
And you must have to think about how students will be learning in 5 years' time.
That is absolutely right, because we can build these things. You know, we can just get the diggers in, get the cranes in, put up a structure. That's not really the central reason for doing this, actually. It's to provide a much more enhanced student and staff experience. But the question that's coming back to us is, what will that student experience be like? You know, what does a 21st century university look like in terms of its teaching and learning environment? So do we have lecture theatres? You know, what's the role of IT? Do we have a kind of MOOC? And how do we have blended learning? I don't know the answers to these questions, but it provides a fantastic forum to talk about it. And just one example thing I was reading yesterday, actually, to do with the iPlayer. I use it, I'm sure you do as well. This is a podcast. And that's changing the way people access television. You know, when I was a kid, there were 3 TV channels. You just sat down and watched it in the family at the same time. And if you missed the programme, that was it. You know, now with iPlayer, you can watch TV anytime, anywhere, on mobile devices. And I think that's quite a good analogy for what could happen for education in the next 4 or 5 years, that the idea of a standard lecture set at a certain time for X minutes in front of a big class using PowerPoint is surely past its sell-by date. Yeah. So how do we use technology in a MOOC way, but not massive? We have this notion of a SOOC, which is a small open course, a SOOC, not a MOOC, which would be a combination of blended learning through technology, where you can imagine lots of the lectures would be just delivered. You download them on iPads, read them on the train, read them coming to work, anytime you want. You know, it's 24/7. You can access the lecture material, because fundamentally that doesn't really change. But then it's, how do you follow up? What's the blended bit? How would you then make sure the student experience is bespoke through a kind of, I don't know, a tutorial system, or you know, a far more boutique experience for students, at the same time using technology to provide a lot of the heavy lifting.
So you might be building a campus with no lecture theatres in it.
Well, that's an open. That's a good question, isn't it? Perhaps.
Professor Nick Petford, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Pleasure, thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.